So our talk this afternoon is depression, anxiety, suicidality, and integrative approach. What is depression? What is major depression, major depressive disorder? It is a complex brain-body disease that has changes in brain structure, both brain circuits functionally and structurally, as well as changes in your neuroendocrine system, meaning your immune response and your hormone responses. And this reacts back upon the brain, causing cellular and genetic expression changes in the brain tissue. Now, what makes somebody vulnerable to this process? The genetics that they have, our DNA, and then the environment in which we live. There was a gene that was discovered some time ago, and that's this gene here. It's what this represents, SS and LL. There was a gene discovered some time ago that codes for a transporter that transports a neurochemical called serotonin. How many has heard of serotonin? Yeah. It's a brain neurochemical.
And when the neuron releases that neurochemical into a gap between the two neurons, that gap is called a synapse. The neuron that releases it has little vacuums.
We lost you.
The mic went out.
I bet the battery's died.
I'll get you some.
Okay.
Chronic healing. So, when one neuron wants to talk to another neuron, it releases a chemical in a little gap called a synapse, and the neuron that releases it has a little vacuum cleaner called a reuptake pump that will suck it back in after the signal, repackage it, and release it again. You have genes that code for these various pumps, and one of them codes for the serotonin pump. And it was discovered some time ago that if you have two versions of the short arm, in the human genome, there's two versions of the gene, a short arm version and a long arm version. And you get one copy from mom, one copy from dad. So you can have two shorts, a short and a long, or two longs. And it was discovered if you had the short arm version of this gene, you have a higher rate of depression than if you have the long arm version. So people said, here's a gene that codes for depression. But then a little more research discovered that, in fact, this gene does not code for depression. What this gene codes for, if you have the short-arm version, is it codes for sensitivity to your environment. So if you have the short-arm version of this gene and you grow up in a home with conflict, arguments, hostility, abuse, neglect, a traumatic or harmful, toxic environment, then you have higher rates of depression than people who grow up in that environment with a long-arm version. But if you have the short-arm version, you grew up in a nurturing, loving, supportive environment, you actually have less depression than people with the long-arm version, and you end up being a leader in society. So the short-arm version codes for sensitivity to what you're experiencing in the environment. That's what this shows here. The blue represents no trauma or adversity in childhood. The green is probable, and the red is severe trauma or violence in the home. On the left, we have the two long-arm version, people with two long-arm versions, the long and the short, and two shorts. And you notice in the red, if you have severe abuse in the childhood, then if the short-arm version, you have much more depression than a short and a long or the two longs. But if you have no abuse or trauma in the childhood, then it's the two short-arm versions that have less depression than the long-arm version. And so what, again, is happening is your genes are not coding for the depression. They're coding for how we respond to the things we experience in our environment. Now, what happens in the brain circuits when somebody is depressed? When somebody's in a state of depression, the part of the brain where they reason and think, the dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex, this is the part where you reason, think, problem solve, plan, anticipate. This part of the brain is underactive. So people who have depression have a hard time focusing, concentrating, problem solving. They get overwhelmed very easily or very quickly. The part of the brain where you experience love for other people and make decisions is also underactive. And so people feel emotionally disconnected from others, and they have a hard time making decisions. They're ambivalent. They don't know what to do. The part of the brain that gives you a conviction of wrongdoing is overactive in depression, so people feel inappropriate guilt, shame, inadequacy, like they're not doing anything right. The part of the brain that causes anxiety and fear is overactive, so they feel dread, worry, apprehension. the part of the brain where we experience pleasure, any type of pleasure. You just ate your favorite dessert and go, oh, that was so good. Or you just fallen in love and you're walking on air. All pleasure is processed in the nucleus accumbens. People with depression, that part of the brain becomes unresponsive. So not only do they have problems planning, organizing, focusing, concentrating, feel disconnected, have a hard time making decisions, feel inappropriate guilt, worry excessively about things. Even if something good happens in their life, there's no joy. There's no positive emotional experience from it. This is what's happening in the brain of people that have depression. We talked about the salience network this morning, so I'm not going to walk through it again. Just remember, salience network is relevance or significance. And when the salience network is out of balance, then what happens is people get inappropriate senses of guilt, and that's what happens in depression. The salience network becomes imbalanced. They get those ruminating, worried, anxious loops going. And we talked about what happens if our alarm circuit doesn't turn off this morning. And if it doesn't turn off, it activates our immune system that I went through this morning. Activating the immune system kicks up these inflammatory factors that I talked about this morning, and that can cause increasing risk for metabolic diseases like obesity, diabetes, and high cholesterol, and so forth. But what I didn't mention is they also interfere with normal synaptic signaling. That's the communication between neurons. So if I injected you with a syringe full of these inflammatory cytokines, within a short period of time, you'd start experiencing extreme fatigue, malaise, concentration problems, nausea, loss of appetite, sleep disturbance, and these are the symptoms that people have when they're depressed because these inflammatory cytokines interfere with the nervous system's ability to communicate amongst itself, the neuron-to-neuron signals. So when this happens, then these inflammatory cytokines are circulating in our circulation, and our brain will pick up on this, and it will cause a cascade of changes inside the brain. Now, this is a picture of a synapse. This is a presynaptic neuron. That's a postsynaptic neuron. That little tiny space there is your synapse, the gap between them. These little circles here are called vesicles, and they're filled with neurotransmitters like serotonin. And when the neuron fires, they will connect to the membrane and release that neurotransmitter into that little space. And there's pumps there that will bring it back in, repackage it into more vesicles. And this is kind of a graphic, just drawing the thing where you can see it this way. Now, what's highlighted here, though, is something called an astrocyte. And if you want to remember what an astrocyte does, it's a white cell. The neurons are gray cells in your brain, if you want to remember that neurons versus the white cells. The white cells are the supporting cells. If you want to remember what an astrocyte does, remember astronaut. Because an astronaut never goes out into space without their spacesuit, right? And the spacesuit gives the astronaut a healthy environment, a milieu where the astronaut can survive. The job of the astrocyte is the spacesuit. It buffers potassium, calcium, releases neurotrophins, provides a nice milieu to keep the neurons healthy. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. Now, those inflammatory cytokines we were talking about, because we're chronically worried, chronically stressed, have our neural circuits out of balance, so our amygdala's kicked up, we got the loops going, we're telling our immune system we're in fight or flight mode, so the immune system's kicking up all these inflammatory cytokines. Those inflammatory cytokines circulate in our blood circulation. So that's our circulation right there. And this is a graphic of cells inside our brain. And one of the cells inside our brain's a little white cell called a microglia, is monitoring what's happening in our blood. And it sees this increased inflammation, and that sends a signal here to alter production pathways. And inside the cells of your body, there are little factories, and these little factories make things. One of the things inside your neurons that your factories make would be neurotransmitters like serotonin or norepinephrine or dopamine. The little factories inside the cell make them. This cell makes serotonin. But what happens when this inflammatory cascade kicks up? It sends a signal to the cell to shut down the serotonin factory. Have anybody heard of tryptophan? It's an amino acid you get in food. If you eat turkey and you get sleepy after eating turkey, which is common on Thanksgiving in America, turkey's high in tryptophan. So when people eat turkey, get sleepy, it's because the tryptophan is being turned into serotonin in their brain and it's making them sleepy. Because tryptophan is the precursor amino acid that your brain uses in its little factory to make serotonin. But with this inflammatory cascade, the serotonin factory gets turned off, that pathway shuts down, and a new pathway opens up, and tryptophan now gets turned into something called quinolinic acid instead of turning into serotonin. And quinolinic acid is toxic to astroglia. It damages them. So you're out in space in your spacesuit, and little micrometeors come along and start punching holes in your spacesuit, and you start ventilating atmosphere. You are not a happy astronaut. And so what happens when our astroglia begin to be damaged, you notice over here now, instead of buffering the potassium and calcium, it starts releasing inappropriate amounts of it, which then damage neurons. Neurons begin to die in the brain. And specifically, well, you can't see all this, but there's a particular gene in our neurons that get turned off, and that gene produces a chemical that's fertilizer for our neurons. Think about what fertilizer does to plants. It causes the plants to grow. These proteins, when our brain makes them, causes our brain to be able to sprout new connections. We can learn faster, keeps our neurons healthy from dying, and it actually prevents us from experiencing depression. When these genes get turned off, we can't branch out our new connections. We start withering the connective trees, and neurons begin to die, and this is what corresponds when somebody's in depression. So, and that's the gene, that's the fertilizer called BDNF. And so what happens is chronic inflammatory cascade turns off the fertilizer, BDNF. It also damages the receptors. We talked about our fire chief this morning. The fire chief gets damaged, so we lose our inhibition feedback, so we call for more and more of these stress hormones. So now we have a reinforcing loop going, causing for more inflammation, and the inflammation is causing these things to turn off. It's damaging the inhibition that we should be having, and so it just reinforces at this point. And then another gene, you don't need to remember the name of this gene, but this gene is altered in people who've gone through trauma, and this particular gene being altered in its expression, altered in expression. So in your body you have chromosomes. Chromosomes are containing genetic information. Genetic information is simply information. Consider it a library, and in the library are a lot of books, and in the books there's chapters, and the chapters are made up of words and letters. That's what your DNA is. You've got molecules that are letters that group together to form words, that group together to form genes. Those genes would be chapters that have instructions that you follow to make things, like a recipe, okay? You can either open the books or close the books. Genes can be turned on or genes can be turned off. What happens with life experiences, molecules will come in and lock onto a particular area of our DNA where a gene is, and we'll lock that book down. We lose that information. We can't produce what's in that recipe anymore until it's opened again. That's what's described here. This inflammatory cascade is shutting down access to the information to produce certain proteins, and when that happens, this counts for 80% of the suicide risk in trauma survivors, this gene being turned off. If you turn the gene back on, their risk of suicide reduces by 80%. So there are real biological aspects to what's happening in people's brains from life experiences that make them vulnerable to these illnesses and even suicide. This is a functional scan called a PET scan, positron emission tomography. It's looking at metabolism in real time in a brain. The brain on the right is a non-depressed brain. The brain on the left is a depressed brain. And this is not a post-stroke brain. Those neurons are not dead. They're just not active. They're not firing. And that's what's happening in the brain of somebody who's got depression. And this is important to realize because I've heard in certain Christian circles that people would suggest somebody with depression has got, you know, just not enough faith, or they've got a, you know, a belief problem or something like this. And really, they've got a physiological problem going on in their brain and body. Now, this is an interesting study. It was a very powerful study. And what I mean by powerful, when you think of the studies you read in the science, there's something called retrospective studies. A retrospective study is where they will send out a survey and they will ask you to answer questions from your memory about things you went through in the past. You're trying to recall things that you've gone through. Did you go through this or that or the other thing? And how old are you? And so it's retrospective, dependent on your memory. Those are not considered as powerful or as reliable as prospective studies, where they start the study and then they actually watch over time and observe what actually happens when it happens. Those are considered more powerful. This is a prospective study where they actually followed people for 32 years. I'm glad I didn't do that study. And what they did is they identified three measures of childhood adversity. One is overt physical or sexual abuse. That's one measure. Second measure, severe economic poverty. Third measure was neglect, severe neglect or abandonment. If you had none of those, you're represented in the blue bar. If you had one of those, you're represented in the green bar. If you had two or three of those, you're represented in the gray bar. And then they just followed people for 32 years to see who developed depression. And you'll notice if you had no adversity, 12% developed depression. One of those, 20%, two, 30%. And then over here, it's looking at diabetes, obesity, hypercholesterolemia, heart attack, strokes, and you notice it mirrors exactly the depression group because the cascade of events that drive the metabolic problems are the same cascade of events that drive the depression problems, which are the activation of the inflammatory cascades with the increasing cytokines that cause insulin resistance in the body, causing the metabolic problems, and then the changes I just showed you in the brain. So why do imbalances in brain circuitry lead to depression? Because they increase inflammation, turning on the amygdala, which turn on the immune system, which kick up the inflammation, and the inflammation then causes both the metabolic problems and the brain changes of depression. That's why. It's kicking up inflammation. So, understanding that, anything that increases inflammation in your body will increase depression. Doesn't have to come from imbalanced brain circuits. Doesn't have to come from worry. Doesn't have to come from fear-inducing beliefs. Anything that increases inflammation will have the same cascade. And so a study of 9,000 adults examining the amounts of fast food and junk food being consumed, pizzas, hamburgers, donuts, croissants, candies, and cakes, which are highly inflammatory foods, found that those who ate junk food had a 40% higher rate of depression than those who did not. And this was a dose-dependent thing. The more junk food you ate, the more inflammation you got, the more depression you got. So anything that imbalances inflammation increases depression. Smoking. Not only we all know the issues related to smoking and cancer and lung disease and heart disease, but it increases the risk of depression because it increases inflammation. Alcohol abuse increases risk of depression because it increases inflammation. Drug abuse increases risk of depression because it increases inflammation. Type 2 diabetes, highly inflammatory state, increases your risk of depression by 24%. Increases your Alzheimer's disease risk 60%. And that's because that some of the same inflammatory cascades, a whole other set of lectures on dementia. And then chronic pain states, inflammatory state, increases your risk of depression. Anything that increases inflammation increases your risk of depression. Does that make sense to everybody? So what are interventions? Well, what is the number one treatment for depression in the healthcare industry? Antidepressant medications. Right. And how do they work? So this is another just depiction of a synapse. Presynaptic neuron, postsynaptic neuron, releasing the neurotransmitters, stimulating postsynaptic receptors. And when you stimulate the postsynaptic receptor, and then what happens over here, there's little reuptake pumps that will then package this back in. And when you give an antidepressant, the antidepressants come in and they shut down the pumps. So the pumps shut down, which means the neurotransmitters stay out here longer, and if they stay out here longer, they continue to give a signal here. That's how the antidepressants are working. The antidepressants are not getting inside the cells. They're working in the space between the cells to cause the receptors to have a longer signal postsynaptically. And when that happens, then the increased signal here, that's what's happened, serotonin, norepinephrine, increased signal on the receptor causes changes that you have to know all this, but it just starts a cascade of new messengers, and these new messengers go all the way down. This is your DNA, and in your DNA, they turn this protein back on, which is the fertilizer for your neurons. It's called BDNF. It gets turned back on. And when it gets turned back on, you start making new connections again. You start sprouting new dendrites. Your neurons get healthy again. Hopefully we're back on. Okay, and so you get this BDNF turned back on, and this is what treats depression. And every effective treatment for depression, whether it's antidepressant medicines, whether it's shock treatment, whether it's transcranial magnetic stimulation, every effective treatment for depression turns BDNF back on. Okay, and that is ultimately the goal, to get these genes turned back on, where you have healthy sprouting and connecting and keep the neurons healthy. So how effective are antidepressants in doing this? Well, this was a study in which they took individuals who had either first episode of depression, or if they've ever been treated before, they always got well. If you had one episode of depression where you took a treatment and you didn't get well, you can't be in a study. So we're taking people who are most likely to have a good outcome, and then we put them on the antidepressant, and how many, what percentage of people do you think get well with that, that cherry-picked population? 27%. 73% don't get well. And then if you take those who didn't get well and switch them to a second antidepressant, 21% get well. And if you take those who didn't get well from this one and switch them to a third antidepressant, 16% get well. And if they, those who didn't get well here, you switch to another antidepressant, you're about 7% get well. And so it doesn't mean antidepressants are not effective. If you understand what I've already shared with you, antidepressants are doing one thing. They're doing what they're doing. And what's happening here, why this is going down, is because we're picking out, we're screening out the patients who can get well simply by turning on BDNF with a pharmaceutical. But this does nothing to stop the inflammatory cascades. This doesn't do anything about the high junk food or the alcohol or the tobacco or the lack of exercise or the sleep disorders or anything else that is driving them into depression, okay? It is simply trying to turn it back on, but if the pressure, if their lifestyle is such that they have so much drive to keep that shut down, the antidepressants alone are not going to overcome it. So this is why antidepressants alone are often not very effective. They need to be integrated in a holistic approach to treating the individual. So what are non-drug treatments? What can we do besides medication? And I tell people you have to think, when you've got this idea in mind, you should be thinking, okay, what are the contributing factors in this person's life that is driving this inflammatory cascade that is causing the depression? And people have different factors. Some people smoke, some people don't. Some people drink, some people don't. Some people work third shift. Working third shift is an inflammatory condition that increases your risk of depression. Some people don't work third shift. Some people are in conflictual marriages where they argue all the time. That's a high stress state, et cetera, et cetera. I'm going to give you some more examples here. And so you have to look at the individual life and go down an inventory of things and try to bring interventions that will address that particular person's inflammatory state to reduce inflammation in their life. Does that make sense to everyone? Did I go too fast? I can do this. You know I am from Tennessee, don't you? So I can talk with a southern accent if you'd rather. But let's see here. We'll be here about... No, you don't want to do that. Okay. Lifestyle factors. So we look at lifestyle factors to reduce inflammation. And first lifestyle factor is exercise. When you exercise regularly, exercising regularly resensitizes your insulin receptors by, here's how it works. When you exercise regularly, your muscles produce something called interleukin-10. Interleukin-10 is an anti-inflammatory cytokine. Remember, under stress and worry, our macrophages begin releasing these other cytokines. Yeah, I didn't tell you what they were, but they're inflammatory. Interleukin-10 reduces them. So exercise has an anti-inflammatory effect, reducing the inflammatory cytokines that are causing insulin resistance, which causes insulin sensitivity. Additionally, exercise not only turns on directly BDNF, there are other growth factors besides BDNF, and exercise is the only intervention that turns them all on. Medications will turn on BDNF, but medications will not turn on vascular growth factor or nerve growth factor, which are also fertilizers for your neuron. Exercise turns them all on. So exercise is very healthy for us. It also increases endorphins and enkephalins and dopamine. It has a mood-enhancing effect for us. And a 2017 study found 33,000 people followed for 11 years found that 1 hour per week of leisure time exercise, that is not a lot of exercise. Just 1 hour a week. See, if you do more, you can get a better benefit. Reduced depression by 12%. Just 1 hour a week of leisure exercise. That's like going out and playing tennis with your wife for 1 hour a week. That's going for a bike ride with your kids for 1 hour a week. This is leisure exercise. This is not hardcore stuff, but you still get the benefits from it. This is going for a walk with your wife 30 minutes twice a week. That's what that is. It's very leisure, and you still get this benefit. You'll get more benefit with more consistent exercise. Nutrition, dietary changes. L-methylfolate. Let's talk about that for a minute. How many have heard of folic acid or folate? Okay, it's a B vitamin, B9. It is required, folate is required in your brain for your brain to make dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin, your neurotransmitters. 50% of people with depression have a genetic mutation where they cannot metabolize folic acid from food, into the form the brain needs. Folic acid from food cannot get into your brain. You eat green leafy vegetables high in folic acid, that's great. But if you have this gene defect, it never gets to your brain, because to get to your brain, it has to be metabolized. It's a two-step process to turn into methylfolate. And only methylfolate can cross your blood-brain barrier, where it's required as a cofactor for your brain to make dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin. Think about this. Little Debbie Factory makes Little Debbies. Anybody heard of Little Debbies? Never heard of them? Yeah. Anybody ever eaten one? You know, they're made in Collegedale, where I live. Okay. Little Debbie Factory makes Little Debbies. Trucks move Little Debbies around. Metaphorically speaking, these are the transporters. They transport them. Antidepressants and medicines work on the transporters. They don't do anything about the factory production. L-methylfolate, though, would be like peanut butter and flour that the factory needs to produce what goes in the trucks. And so 50% of people with depression have a gene defect where they're not giving their brain a methylated folate. You just give them L-methylfolate, and it has the same antidepressant benefit as giving them an antidepressant if they have this gene defect. So it's a very simple solution. You can get it over the counter in 1 milligram strength. You can get it in prescription at 2.5, 5, and 15 milligram strength, depending on what the doctor gives you. Omega-3 fatty acids are from primarily fish or fish oil. They're the ones your brain needs are the long chain DHA EPA. The stuff out of flaxseed is ALA, and your brain can't use that, and your body only converts about 1% of that into the long chain form. And 70% of the fat in your brain is long chain omega-3 fats. One of the factors in postpartum depression is that during pregnancy, a woman is giving up omega-3s out of her body and brain for the developing fetal brain. And then postpartum, when she breastfeeds, breast milk is high in omega-3s. Her body is giving up her omega-3s for the nurturing of her baby's brain. If she's not being supplemented with omega-3 long chain DHA EPA, it increases the risk of postpartum depression. That's why most prenatal vitamins now are supplemented with omega-3s. Vitamin D, if you're low in vitamin D, you have an increased risk for depression. And vitamin D is not something you just want to go out and take, because you can get toxic on it. If you're low in vitamin D, it increases all causes of death. If you have a level below 25, all causes of death go up. It also increases your risk of dementia 2.5 times. Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. If you have a level above 1.4, then it increases your risk of all causes of death. So you don't want to go out and just jack up on this, because it's a fat-soluble vitamin. You can get toxic. You need to have your doctor draw a blood level. In Chattanooga, where I live, it's a southern state, 70% of the population is vitamin D deficient, because even though we live in sunny states, nobody really works outside anymore. We're inside all the time. Truly. That's the case. Avoid junk food, eat a healthy diet, and then sleep. Let's talk about sleep for a minute. Your brain is 2 to 3% of your body weight. 2 to 3% of your body weight. But it uses 20% of your body energy. Meaning it's highly metabolic, burning up lots of calories, lots of fuel. And when you burn up fuel, guess what happens after you burn fuel? There's waste products. And those waste products are toxic. They have to be cleared out of your brain. During sleep, your neurons actually contract and expel out of the inside of the neurons the waste products of metabolism into the cerebral spinal fluid to be cleared out of your brain. If you don't get adequate sleep, then you're allowing over the course of time, this is not a night or two or traveling, getting a little jet lag, this is a chronic sleep problem, you will these waste products of metabolism build up, and it increases oxidative stress on your brain, increasing your risk of depression as well as dementia as you age. And there are certain sleep disorders like obstructive sleep apnea, where you're not actually breathing well at night, your oxygen levels are fall, that directly associated with depression. The good news is you treat it, the depression clears. Eliminate toxins like tobacco, alcohol, drugs, obviously. So lifestyle factors, what we're doing, and all these things are connected because we're reducing inflammation. That's what we're doing with all these interventions. Factors that restore salience network and decrease amygdala firing. So anything that will cause us to feel less worry, less anxiety, less stress, a greater sense of well-being, so meditating on the God of love, anything that calms the amygdala reduces the signal to the immune system to stay turned on, so it reduces inflammation. What is it that disrupts the salience network? We talked about this morning: denial, refusing truth, believing lies, exploiting others, grudge holding, and social isolation. We didn't talk about that one this morning. Social isolation also disrupts salience network and kicks up the immune system. Loneliness. We talked about the truth and the cognitive and therapies that actually reconnect salience network this morning. Loneliness in the 21st century. You know, because of the internet, we work on the internet, play on the internet, search on the internet, shop on the internet, study, and yet we interact less with people. Supposedly, it is a social media, but we actually become more socially disconnected since the age of the internet. Did you all know that? Okay? There are many people that actually go to church now online. They don't come to church. Did you know that? They're socially disconnected. Yeah. And so in 1970, 11 to 17% of adults reported they were lonely in 1970. Today, 40% of adults report loneliness. 40%. Loneliness increases inflammation, depression, Alzheimer's, dementia, suicidal thoughts, and an early death. An interesting study, epigenetics, epi is above, genetics the genome, these are the chemical signals telling which genes to turn on and which genes to turn off. A study of looking at the white blood cells of 6 lonely people were compared to 8 socially connected people. And what they found, there was 209 different genes that were expressed differently. Genes that were associated with inflammation were increased or turned on in the lonely group. And the genes that fight infection were turned off in the lonely group. So that made them more vulnerable to sickness and more vulnerable to inflammatory cascades than the socially connected group. And these findings were confirmed in a second study of 93 individuals looking at the same thing. So loneliness causes increasing stress and worry, which kicks up your immune system. So factors that are protective for kids growing up and reduce their likelihood of mental health problems, suicide, drug, alcohol abuse, depression, are two big factors. One is family member confidant, and that's growing up in a home where you have someone you can actually share your worries, your fears, you can confide in and trust them with your secrets. Kids that grow up in a home where they have someone they can truly confide in and feel supported by have better mental health and less mental health problems than kids who don't. And then the other is family cohesion. And family cohesion is that sense that we have each other's back. We protect each other. We watch out for each other. We don't make fun of each other. We don't exploit each other. We don't betray each other. We have a family that sticks together and supports each other. Kids that grow up in homes with cohesion and grow up in homes with a confidant have less mental health problems and less alcohol drug problems. They're less likely to drop out of school. They're more likely to have healthy marriages later. They just function better because neurobiologically they grew up in a home where they have to worry less, so their amygdala doesn't fire as much growing up, and therefore they have less inflammatory cascades in their body. Spiritual factors. We talked about Newberg's study this morning, meditating on the God of love, growing the anterior cingulate cortex, calming the amygdala, reducing inflammatory cascades. What about belief in God? Several studies have shown that a belief in God, but not religious affiliation, was associated with better treatment outcomes for depression. Belief in God, but not religious affiliation. Another study found a belief in God, but not religious practice, reduced hopelessness and reduced depression. And then they looked a little deeper, and the real deal was it was the belief in a benevolent or concerned God that offered hope or hopefulness that was really the key in reducing depression. So if the belief in God doesn't increase our hope, then it didn't have a positive benefit. They looked at prayer and outcomes. In the aftermath of September 11, 2001, University of Michigan looked at those followed people and looked at their adjustment to the trauma 1 year later and found that those who prayed regularly had a better social adjustment 1 year later than those who did not pray regularly. But then they looked at survivors of the war in Bosnia-Herzegovina, Bosnia's survivors, 60% of them had PTSD. 77% of these had negative forms of prayer, where they would pray for God to pour wrath out or vengeance upon their enemies. And what they found was the Muslims who had positive prayers had high level of optimism, hope, and healthy adjustment. But those with the negative forms of prayers, praying for vengeance on their enemies, did not have healthy adjustment, positive attitude, or hopefulness. So praying alone is not sufficient to bring healthy outcomes. It actually depends upon whom you're praying to and what you're actually praying for. That matters. Altruism, we talked about the volunteering today. People who volunteer have better health. They stay out of nursing homes longer, less dementia, less depression, because volunteering activates the anterior cingulate cortex and lowers the inflammatory cascades from lowering the amygdala. And so this is why healthy spirituality has a benefit for reducing depression and slowing aging. It activates your higher cortexes, which calms your amygdala, lowering the immune response and inflammatory cascade. It reduces anxiety and worry, resolves wrongs. So people who have a healthy spirituality are more likely to forgive rather than hold grudges, which means it will calm their salience network. They're more likely to repent rather than deny, which means they're going to calm their salience network and calm their amygdala. So healthy spirituality has a real neurobiological benefit. They have healthier lifestyles generally, taking care of the spirit temple, so they're less likely to abuse their bodies with the toxins and the things that drive inflammation. And they have healthier relationships, so they're less likely to stay in conflict with people, again, calming the amygdala, reducing inflammatory cascades. And we talked about this already, so we'll move on. So what reconnects the salience network? I think this is important to emphasize. Truth, repentance, forgiveness, and love for others reconnects the salience network. These are the big four things. Isn't that profound? That's neurobiological, guys. Reducing inflammatory cascades, promoting better physical health, and then you can see some of the promises in the Bible that when you follow God's perspectives, you get promises for long. For there's a promise: honor your mother and father, that the days that your days on earth might be long. Right? So many people view that as, okay, if you keep the rule, God will use power from heaven to magically give you long life. But if you don't keep the rule, God will use power from heaven to make sure you die young. That's how many people see that. No, it is directly related to what I'm teaching you here. You see, your prime relationships are your early relationships, your child-parent relationships. If you grew up in a home where there's conflict and argument and hostility and abuse, you have epigenetic changes altering your brain structure. You have more inflammatory cascades. You come into adulthood more suspicious, less capable of trusting people. You end up repeating conflict throughout your life, keeping your inflammatory cascades going. You cause all this metabolic illnesses and you die young. This is what the data shows. People who have healthy parent-child relationships, though, learn how to trust others, have calm amygdalas, grow up with discernment, able to set healthy boundaries, have healthy relationships, not conflicts, and thus they have lower inflammatory cascades and they live longer. This is not magic. This is how God built us to run. This is a just simply showing from 2001 to 2017, females, males, and then the entire population, suicide rates per 100,000 people from 2001 to today. And you'll notice it's a gradual increasing trend. Women significantly less than men, but they're both increasing over the last 20 years. Why more depression? Why more anxiety? Why more suicidality? Historically in America, there have been three other-centered objects, three values taught in this country that were larger than you and worthy of your sacrifice and service to support. And the big three were God, family, and country. This is historic in this country. And these three values people would give of themselves. If you remember back in 1960, there was a Democratic president who said, "Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country." Does anybody remember hearing that? Okay, notice the focus there. It is service-oriented. What can I give to the country? Because the country is larger than me. That's altruistic. That's other-centered. Do you understand that there's been a corrosion in this country of narcissism where nothing is greater than the self? And everything is owed the self, and self becomes the center. So in the country today, there is no God. Families are dysfunctional. And the country is not to be trusted. It abuses the minorities in the other countries of the world, and it has it does not deserve our service. And so when you do that, what happens is you leave people disconnected from anything greater than themselves. And when you're the greatest thing in the world and there's nothing greater than you, then you are left in isolation and loneliness, which only increases fear and anxiety. And mental health problems increase. And this is today's Western society. No meaning, no purpose other than self. And this is why we're getting more violence in society as well. Not only more suicide, more violence upon others, because nothing is bigger than me. It's quite a deep corrosion. So in summary, depression is a debilitating illness that is physiological in nature, with altered brain structure and function, with altered immune response, with altered gene expression, with altered cellular function, and brain changes. Antidepressants alone are often inefficient or not sufficient to get a person well, because they're not addressing a bunch of other factors that are driving the depression. But there is an absolute place for antidepressants in the overall treatment plan for a patient. And treatment should be comprehensive and individualized, meaning don't have a cookie-cutter plan that you just put everybody on, but you assess the individual and what their particular factors are and bring interventions to bear in their life. And so now,